Now, having cleared up certain misconceptions, it's time to proceed, time to press ahead and come to the second part of the lecture and say what a guru is. But first of all, a word of warning. A word of warning against possible misunderstanding of what has been said so far. As I remarked the other evening, the possibilities of misunderstanding are infinite. I've said that the guru is not the head of a religious group. He's not a teacher, he's not a father substitute, and he's not a problem solver. But that means, one must be careful to say, that means that the guru as such is not any of these things. The guru per se is not any of these things. But that does not mean that he may not, at times, or from time to time, function in these different ways. The guru may even be the head of a religious group. So I would say from my own observation and experience, this very rarely happens indeed. Because one might say that the qualities that make one a guru are not necessarily those which make for promotion within the ecclesiastical system. Much more often, the guru may be a teacher, or be functioning as a teacher, outwardly, externally. And in Buddhism, this is very often the case. But it remains important to distinguish the teacher from the guru as such. Some gurus may be teachers, but this by no means means that all teachers are gurus. A guru may even provisionally function as a father substitute or a problem solver, but the emphasis is on provisionally. As soon as possible, he'll discard this role and function as a guru. Of course, a guru can function, apart from functioning directly as a guru, can function in other ways. He can function, for instance, even as a physician, as a psychotherapist, as an artist, as a poet, as a musician, or even just as a friend. Can function in these ways without being identified with any of these roles. All right. What the guru is, or what a guru is. It has been said that there are many different ways of being bad, of being wicked. An amazing number of different ways. But only one way of being good, which in the eyes of some people makes goodness rather dull and uninteresting. One could also say that there are many errors, but only one truth. And similarly, that there are many misconceptions about the guru, but only one true conception. So there's quite a lot to be said about what the guru is not, and comparatively little to be said about what the guru is. In fact, what the guru is, positively, can be disposed of quite briefly. But this doesn't mean it isn't important or that it's less important. If anything, it means that it's more important. Because, as I've said once before, the more important a thing is from the spiritual point of view, the less there is to be said about it. To begin with, perhaps above all else, the guru is one who stands on a higher level of being and consciousness than ourselves. Stands on a higher level of being and consciousness than ourselves. Or to put it in a word, one who is more aware, one who is more evolved, one who is more developed, In the second place, the guru is one with whom we are in regular contact. This contact may, of course, take place at different levels. It may take place on the physical plane, in the ordinary manner, ordinary social manner. Or it may take place on a higher spiritual plane, as it were, telepathically, the contact of mind directly with mind. Again, there may even be contact between the guru and the disciple in dreams or during meditation. But the ordinary disciple, the relatively undeveloped disciple, will obviously need regular physical contact on the material plane. For his needs, or so far as his needs are concerned, it won't be enough to see the guru just at long intervals. Preferably, he should be in day-to-day contact with the guru, even live under the same roof. Thirdly, contact between the guru and the disciple should be what we may describe as existential. Now, it isn't easy to explain what is meant by that. One might paraphrase it by saying that there should be, between the guru and the disciple, real communication, which means not just communication or sharing of thoughts or ideas or feelings or experiences, even spiritual experiences, but communication of being. If you like, action and interaction of being, which implies each being as fully as possible himself in relation to the other. It isn't the guru's business to teach the disciple anything. It's the guru's business to be himself in relation to the disciple. And it's not the business of the disciple as such to learn. What he has to do is simply to expose himself to the being and to the effect of the being of the guru, and at the same time be himself in relation to him. Now, communication is of two kinds. There's what we may call horizontal communication and what we may call vertical communication. Horizontal communication is communication between two people on more or less the same level of being and consciousness. And vertical communication is that between people on different levels of being and consciousness, one higher and one lower. And it's this sort of communication, this vertical communication, that we find taking place as between guru and disciple. Now, in all communication, whether horizontal or whether vertical, there is what we may describe as mutual modification of being. Mutual modification of being. In the case of horizontal communication, this means that in the course of communication, any one-sidedness that one may have is corrected. People who really communicate, become progressively more like each other. At the same time, paradoxical as it may seem, they become more truly themselves. Suppose, for example, a very rational person truly communicates, with a very emotional person. As a result of that communication, the rational person will become more emotional. the emotional person will become more rational. It's as though each rubs off on the other. Each will become more like the other. At the same time, the rational person has not just had emotionality, as it were, added to him from the outside. Through or by means of the communication with the emotional person, he has been enabled, or she has been enabled, to develop his own undeveloped emotionality, which was, in fact, there all the time, as it were, beneath the surface. In other words, the communication, by enabling him to correct that imbalance, to bring up what was there but in abeyance, has enabled him to become more himself. And it's the same with the emotional person. Now, this is what happened in the case of horizontal communication, but what happens in the case of vertical communication, that is to say, communication between the guru and the disciple? How do they affect each other? How do they modify each other? How do they rub off on each other? Well, the disciple becomes more like the guru. But the guru does not become more like the disciple. The disciple changes, but the guru does not change. The disciple, under the pressure, as it were, of that communication, that vertical communication, rises eventually in the scale of being and consciousness. The disciple evolves. In fact, by virtue of his communication, real communication, vertical communication with the guru, the disciple is even compelled to evolve. In a sense, he has no choice. He can only stop evolving by breaking off the communication, breaking off the relationship altogether. But of course, if he's a real disciple, he can't even do this. Sometimes it's said that the true disciple is like a little bulldog, a bulldog puppy. I don't know whether you know, but if you have a bulldog puppy and you take a piece of rag, say a towel or something like that, and you just dangle it in front of his nose, he'll snap at it and seize it in his little jaws. And you can then pick him up and whirl him round your head, but he'll never let go. And the true disciple is like that.